Okay, everyone, welcome to the second day of the ALM Summit. And we have Brian this morning. Are you ready, Brian?
I'm ready.
All right.
All right. Everybody can hear me? Is the mic going okay?
Yep.
All right, good. Thank you. Thanks for coming this morning. It's good to see everybody. A lot of faces I recognize, and I'm glad to have you here. So I'm going to talk a bit today. This is going to be a little bit of an interesting meandering talk. I'm going to talk a little bit about sort of trends that we see in the industry around application lifecycle management, development practices. I think yesterday Jason talked about trends around what we call modern apps and the kind of experiences that people are building. I'm going to talk about the kinds of ways people are building those apps and what that means for us as developers and for us as tool vendors. I'm also then going to talk a little bit about our experience as we as a development team have gone through that process of moving from, if you go back far enough, a very waterfallian kind of experience to where we are today, where we're shipping a cloud service every 3 weeks, patching it on demand and really having to live the life of an online software as a service team. And then I'm going to do a little bit of talk about some product stuff and stuff we've been doing and stuff that we are going to be doing and hopefully that'll be fun. I'll do a few demos. All right, so application lifecycle trends. First, change. It seems like change, whether it's technology or business, is just constantly accelerating. I mean, the rate at which new platforms are coming out, new user experiences, new programming models, it just dizzies the mind. And keeping up with that can be incredibly difficult. Changing requirements, the way businesses operate, the way they interact with customers, the degree to which they need to evolve their technology becomes an incredibly important part of competitive advantages for companies in almost every industry. There's been a motion, over the last 10 years of gradually, maybe even 12 or 14 years, of really focus on the process of software development and how do we improve it. And obviously, the Agile movement has been, and continues to be an incredibly important part of that. In the last few years, sort of inspired by some thinking in manufacturing, the lean movement has also become a significant force. You hear people talk about build, measure, learn, and that virtuous cycle, and this idea that, I have an idea, I'm going to build some minimum viable product, some small test of that idea, put it out there. Observe customer behavior around that idea, measure it, understand whether or not what I have done is achieving the goal that I set out to achieve, learn from that, design kind of the next increment, and sort of go from there. And that in this model, really it becomes all about iterating as quickly as you possibly can. You've got to be able to execute, build, measure, learn rapidly, and some would argue that the competitor that executes build, measure, learn fastest wins. Now it's funny, Lori Lampkin, who's the director of PM on my team, she really prefers to insert another word in here. She calls it think, build, measure, learn. So I think there is an important component of that. And then, of course, we are relying on, in order to execute build, measure, learn, we're relying very heavily on continuous feedback and the ability to get new increments of software out there very quickly and then collect good feedback. And not just sort of anecdotal feedback. I mean, we've been collecting anecdotal feedback for a long time. Microsoft, for example, we have Connect, we have forums, we use User Voice. We have lots of ways of collecting anecdotal feedback. But more and more, you see people relying on more hard data on what people are actually doing, and I'll talk more about that. Another trend is the blurring of functional boundaries within the software development team. So, 10 years ago, there was a lot of focus on on changing the way developers and testers work together, with kind of the introduction of practices like unit testing and continuous integration and various processes that were about really moving quality earlier in the process. And we did a bunch of work in that time frame in 2005 and 2008 around product features to really help that. You know, the sort of new trend of the last few years, and I think really quite honestly of the next several years, is the blurring between development and operations. If we're going to make this cycle go really fast, kind of the old model of an operations team that sits in their silo and, you know, takes stuff from the dev team and spends 3 months doing hardware acquisition and, you know, deployment planning and pre-production testing and all of the stuff that they go through, you just can't do it. So that model has to change. And then, you know, another phenomenon we see is a lot more distributed teams. As technology enables working from home, working remote, you know, you see companies much more amenable to hiring talent wherever it is. You know, sort of let's get the best talent wherever they are, and then let's make the development team and the development process work. So these trends are important. They're changing things both about the way people use software, but they're changing an awful lot about how we build software. So I talked a little bit about this, and this is there's sort of two models here combined. One is build, measure, learn. I talked a little bit about that and the idea of iteration, sort of popularized by the Lean Startup by Eric Ries. I don't know how you pronounce it. It's a good book. If you haven't read it, it's worth a read. And then this notion of DevOps commerce, which is something that's been big in the e-commerce space for a long time. This idea that the success of any software project really involves all three elements. You're going to build something, you're going to operate something, and you're going to measure the financial success of that thing. And historically, you know, we focused very core on dev. We paid a little bit of attention to ops, and we as developers left it to somebody else to worry about the commerce side. And that's been changing a lot in some industries more than other industries. But as developers get sort of more in touch with why am I building this thing? What is the expected outcome? What is the, you know, the revenue benefit of doing this? What's my ROI? We pay a lot more attention to that in order to be more competitive. So this is a diagram we've been using for a while to talk about sort of the activities in this cycle and turning this cycle, you know, very quickly. We talk about definition, and, you know, that's requirements gathering. It's sort of feedback managing, backlog planning, you know, grooming, prioritization, sort of all of those activities that are around understanding kind of what it is I'm going to build and trying to decide whether I'm going to build the right thing or not. Of course, there's development, and that's sort of all of the activities around building quality software. And as I said, kind of the trend in the last 10 years has been really about pushing quality upstream and into the development process. Operations and particularly that interface between operations and development is, you know, about managing that flow of code off the developer's desktop into the production environment, and how do we make that super fast. And you see people, you know, sort of capabilities in that area are things like release management and managing the flow of code from the developer desktop into some kind of a testing environment and a pre-production environment and a production environment, and figuring out how to do that super quickly with reliable, repeatable deployment steps that you know, don't take the service down when you do it and stuff like that. And then kind of the next is we call adaptation and experimentation, is about particularly in the online services world. The model of software development is very different because, you know, it used to be, and speaking, you know, as someone who's worked at Microsoft a long time, we had a very sort of traditional on-premises product cycle where we'd start out, we'd figure out what we're going to build, we'd build it, we'd you know, even adopted agile practices, and we're doing, you know, iteration and backlog grooming, et cetera. But in the Uber picture, you know, it was still kind of waterfall-ian because we'd build something, we'd ship some previews, we'd then ship a beta, and then we'd get a bunch of feedback on that beta, we'd ship a release candidate, and we'd get some feedback on that, and then we'd ultimately, you know, ship the product, and then millions of people would go install it on their hardware around the world. In online services, it doesn't really work that way. There's only one piece of hardware. Okay, I mean, there's lots of little pieces all aggregated together, but there's kind of one system that you're managing and you're installing and you're keeping up to date, which has some big advantages, but it also introduces some complications. There's no beta per se. Like, how do I ship a beta? I can't ship you a copy of it and let you try it out, because there's just an online service. And so there's a bunch of things that you do. One is exposure control. We have something we call feature flags on our service that enables us to individually enable features for customers. So at any given time, there's some number of customers who have access to features that are deployed on the service that nobody knows about. We have a group of MVPs who are constantly enabling features that are in progress. They get to see them and give us feedback on them. And then at some point, we get it to the point that we're happy with it. We flip a feature flag and no new code's deployed, but suddenly that feature's available to the world. In fact, in about half an hour, we're going to flip a feature flag and you're going to see some cool new stuff that I'm going to talk about in a minute. There's experimentation, which is, hey, I've got an idea for a change that I can make to my application, and here's, you know, what I'm hoping that will do. It'll cause more signups. It'll cause, you know, more active use. It'll cause something, more purchases, whatever it is, more ad impressions. This is often called A/B testing or split testing. You know, how do I make a change and then figure out whether or not that change is effective. Some of those A/B tests are incredibly simple, just changing the wording on a button or the color of a screen, and some of them are very involved, of sort of major changes to software, and it's an incredibly important part of evolving a service. And then sort of collecting all of that feedback about how users are using the system, your experiments and their outcomes, and turning that into kind of the next idea of how I would improve the system. And you know, you need to be able to turn this loop rapidly. In fact, you know, teams that are really, really good at this are often turning this crank on minor changes many times a day, or at least many times a week, to constantly be tweaking things and learning from that and evaluating quickly. So, you know, the transition now, that's sort of industry trends and some of the stuff that we see happening. I want to talk a little bit about our journey. So, you know, 5 years ago, I would have said we were, you know, a fairly, maybe an iterative waterfallian organization. I'm speaking, let me speak fairly narrowly about the Team Foundation server team. And that's been evolving as we've tried to learn how to make our cycle go fast. And we've learned a lot, and we do things a lot differently than we used to. So I would start talking about sort of the team. So the team's very different now than it used to be. You know, we used to have a lot of the same problems that I see in any team around you know, splits of disciplines and gaps between them. We adopted Scrum, what was it, probably two and a half years ago now, that we took, you know, kind of our entire team, sent everybody through Scrum training and got them all up to speed on that practice, and then, you know, went through trying to learn how to do that. I think it took us, we ultimately chose a 3-week sprint cycle for our Scrum practice, and it took us probably 4 sprints of chaos. Like, you know, you're 3 sprints into it and you're going, oh my God, is this ever going to work? And around about the 4th sprint, it finally started to click and teams started to get, oh, this is how this worked. This is what I'm supposed to do. I understand, you know, me as a manager, it was a very difficult thing to go through, because, you know, I was used to having teams say, hey, here's the features I'm going to deliver for this release. And my boss would want to know, hey, what are you guys doing? You know, we're shipping in 18 months. What are you delivering? And trying to figure out how to say to them, well, I'm not sure. I think we're going to deliver, you know, kind of this, but we'll see how far we get. Here's the customer value we're trying to deliver, but I can't actually tell you whether it'll be that feature or, you know, exactly how complete it'll be. So it was a pretty significant cultural shift for us, from all the way down from, you know, really getting our developers, testers, and PMs to work together and do daily sprint stand-ups across the whole discipline, feel accountability across the entire team. If the test team is behind, then the developers start doing testing. If the developers are behind, then the testers start writing features. And literally, that happens in our team. I could probably point to half a dozen or more features in our product that were built by testers on our team because they were in good shape, and there was, you know, features that needed to be built, so the testers built them. So that was a big change for us. Another big change for us has been sort of how we manage kind of the development process, how we manage customer engagement. You know, going from a model of, hey, you plan a big release and then you ship it after 18 months, to a model where we are now, where we ship every 3 weeks, was a huge deal. And it affected us, you know, starting from how we think about planning horizon, because you can't manage, I mean, my team's fairly large, it's over 100 people, and trying to manage kind of what 100 people are doing in sort of 3 week increments is not practical, because people like kind of want to know what the vision for what you're doing is and where you're going. So we adopted kind of a model that said we're going to have an 18 month sort of time horizon that we think about, and that time horizon we'll do planning in sort of very high level customer value. Like, here's the trends in the industry, these are the trends we're going to address. I can't tell you exactly what the features are, but 18 months from now, this is going to be a lot better. And we'll even do some, we generally do some storyboarding around that. I call them aspirational storyboards. They're not designed to actually say what the product is going to be or what the product is going to do, but they're designed to make you go, wow, if we could do that, man, the world would be a lot better. Like, life would be better if we had that. We then kind of take that sort of 18-month chunk, and we break it up into 6-month chunks, and we'll sort of get pretty concrete, say, in the next 6 months, these are the features we're going to deliver. Like, these are the capabilities. Now, again, it doesn't get super precise, and we don't do a ton of design, but we now actually build real storyboards that say, hey, this is what we're going to deliver. This is, these are the capabilities that we plan to build. And then we do kind of about a 2-3 sprint time horizon, where I ask each of my feature teams to kind of give me a cut line, 2-3 sprints out. Say, in the next 2-3 sprints, what user stories, kind of at that level, do you think you're going to get to, so that I can kind of see, are we making good progress? Are we not making good progress? Kind of, what should I expect? You got to sort of manage cross-team dependencies. If one team is slipping and that stuff's looking further out, then and another team is planning to take a dependency on it, you kind of got to manage that. So you got to have some kind of visibility about what's happening. I don't hold teams to it. I don't say, hey, you know, you didn't make what you told me you were going to do 3 sprints from now, so now you're a bad person. But it is just, I think it's an important communication mechanism across teams to understand kind of what the thinking is. And then, of course, we do our core cycle on the 3-week sprints, where that's where we do our design and we do our detailed planning and implementation. And we do a few things around that have worked really super well for us. We introduced this notion of sprint mails. And every beginning of every sprint, teams write a mail that summarizes what they did last sprint and what they plan to do this sprint. And the thing that I really push teams to do, and it has taken a long time to get sort of every team into the right place, is focus, when you're talking about what you delivered, focus on the value you delivered, not on the activities that you performed. And every new team that comes into this, the first thing they do is they write a list of what they did. You know, I tested this thing, I ran this, you know, this test pass, I code reviewed this other thing, and I'm like, hey, that's really cool. I'm glad that you guys did a bunch of work, but that's not what I want you to talk about. I want you to talk about what value you delivered. Think of me as a customer. Tell me what you did that I care about. And one of the ways that we sort of codify that is with sprint demos. So at the end of every sprint, as part of this mail, you're supposed to produce a demo to a video, a short video, usually 2 or 3 minutes, to demonstrate what you accomplished that sprint. And it forces people to the medium of the demo, rather than a list of items, forces people to think about it in terms of customer value rather than activity performed. And so that was sort of a trick that we did that I think has helped us a lot. Another big challenge that we've dealt with is the cadence around quality management is super hard going to 3 weeks. It took us a long time to get people to realize, no. At the end of a sprint, we are shipping. At the end of every sprint, whatever you have checked in, it's shipping. Now, you can hide it behind a feature flag so nobody sees it. Feel free. But the quality of whatever you have at the end of the sprint, that's going live on the hosted service, and it better be good. And we had plenty of sort of trip-ups in the early days, but we're there now. We ship both cloud and on-premises, and we've also tried to increase our pace of on-premises. And right now, we are in the middle of trying to figure out how to ship updates about every 3 months, roughly speaking, of the on-premises product. On-premises is much harder. The nice thing about the cloud is if I do miss something, and in fact, on a 3-week cadence, you can guarantee you're going to miss something almost every time. If I miss something, I can patch it. Like, I can fix it. There's only one copy of it out there in the world I have to fix. We have another process we've worked through is, as a general rule, if we ever discover an issue on the service, almost always, and I'd actually be very hard-pressed to find an exception, almost always the issue is resolved the same day. We will find the issue, get a developer engaged immediately, so we've got a very tight relationship between development and operations, do the diagnostics, get a code fix, get a patch built, and get it deployed, usually within 4 or 5 hours. So it's pretty darn fast that we turn that around. But on-premises, of course, is different, right? So it's installed in thousands or millions of machines, and you can't take that risk that there's a thing that you've got to fix because, boy, it's hard to get it fixed. We shipped update one. Update one, we did, in fact, actually let some things through that I wasn't happy with. We're sort of adjusting our processes for update two. And we're going to try to figure out how to continue to do that better and learn and iterate. And, this is one of the things I've learned about software development is you never get it right. You're always just trying to do it better than you do it today. Release management, a couple aspects. I talked about our ability to patch the service within a few hours. The biggest thing in release management for us was realizing that, hey, this thing's an online service and it can't ever go down. So we used to always think about setup as kind of an after the fact, right? So you'd build a setup and you'd do, testing and various things. But that would come kind of in the second half of the product cycle. Before that, everybody's just using some batch files to, get the bits copied to the right place and configured. But in the cloud, you're going to deploy it, every 3 weeks. And the service can't ever go down. So we spent probably 9 months building a deployment system for our service that allows us to deploy an entirely new set of bits, upgrade any schema changes in the data without the service ever going down. And we've been doing that now for probably 6 months. That was a huge, huge investment. It's probably been more like a year now that I think about it. But it was a huge investment and a big mind shift that the developers, with every single check-in, have to think about the upgrade, because you can't wait till later to figure out what your upgrade problems are. Part of your check-in of a feature has to be, how am I going to upgrade the service to support this feature? Live site mentality has been another big change around figuring out how to get the developers really focused on live site. We've got dashboards of our service up around the halls. Everybody's very well aware of it. First thing I do every morning when I come in is come in and look at our dashboard, go through all the statistics, look for any anomalies, understand kind of what's happening, and send out mails. My devs and my ops team get email from me probably 2 or 3 times a week of something I've seen in our dashboard. I'm like, hey, what's going on here? Why is CPU gone up is higher? How come, you know, builds have dropped, or, you know, sort of whatever it is, we're kind of always poking at that and really understanding what that is. All right. I'm going to move on. I talked a little bit about the cadence. I think I'm not going to spend much more time on this. We kind of have two major cadences, our three-week cloud cadence, and then our roughly three-month box product cadence that we're shipping on. All right, so now I'm going to transition into talking a little bit about sort of what we've been doing in the ALM space. So we've gone to this three-month cadence. We shipped, the first thing we did was ship Update 1. Update 1 had sort of three major pillars in it, agile planning, quality enablement, and some code discovery capabilities. And fundamentally, as we're going, you know, it's kind of this little bit of chicken and egg problem, right? As we go through this three-month cadence, what we're doing is trying to figure out how to build the tools to help other people figure out how to, you know, increase their cadence to whether it's, you know, kind of an on-premises cadence or whether it's a more of a cloud service cadence when you're updating even, you know, very, very frequently. So we did, you know, a bunch of stuff. We added a Kanban board in Update 1. We did enabled cross-browser testing, so you could do Firefox and Chrome. A bunch of SharePoint stuff, code coverage. I'm not going to spend a bunch of time on this. I wrote a ton about it when Update 1 shipped, so I'm not going to bore you with it. But we did a bunch of very, very cool stuff in Update 1. Then, just recently, we released a bunch of DevOps work as part of System Center 2012 SP1, I think it was. Yes, in fact, that's what the title says. So there were sort of three major areas that we focused on there. One was global service monitoring. So you build a service, it's exposed to a bunch of people in the world, or maybe it's even maybe just your distributed employees, or it might be a direct-to-consumer kind of thing. And what you want to know is it alive? And what's my customer experience around those things? And part of that is understanding in the different locations where your users are, what experience are they having? Are they having connectivity problems? Are they having performance problems? You know, what kind of issues are they experiencing? So global service monitoring is now a service, a feature that's up and running in System Center that allows you to, I think it's six locations around the world to basically deploy some of our web tests. You can use Visual Studio to create some web tests. You can then deploy them around the world and have them periodically pull your service and report performance and availability and things like that. So this is a capability we've had on Team Foundation service since the beginning, and it's a very valuable view of what's going on. The second thing we did is we've been working on is some work around improving the diagnostic cycle. So, hey, there's a problem. How do I get discovery quickly? How do I get resolution quickly? How do I improve the communication between the development team and the operations team? So in System Center, we did a couple of things. One, System Center captures a ton of data about events in the production environment. And but we had a bit of a gulf. Like, they'd produce stack traces, and we'd done some work to synchronize Team Foundation Server and System Center to copy diagnostic info. But we had this, you know, super rich diagnostic experience in Visual Studio called IntelliTrace, and this sort of somewhat dumbed down set of diagnostics coming out of System Center that were sort of textual stack traces. So what we did was enable System Center to actually collect IntelliTrace logs. So when there's a problem in production, they capture a trace that you can then load into Visual Studio and use the IntelliTrace diagnostic experience to understand what was going on in production. And then we've made some additional enhancements in Team Foundation Server integration with respect to passing data back and forth between the development team and the ops team. So today, I'm announcing Visual Studio Update 2, CTP 2. That's an interesting number because the first one was a stealth CTP. We never gave it to anybody. It was internal. So it's the first public CTP for Update 2. CTP, of course, means Community Technology Preview. So it's an early look at the next update to Visual Studio and an indication that we're starting to converge on getting that thing done. So kind of the four major categories of work that we're doing there is one, agile planning. So we're going to continue moving forward with agile planning. Quality enablement, so a bunch of work continuing to make sure that developers are building quality code up front and that you're not experiencing production issues. Some good development in the area of line of business, and then just some good overall developer experience improvements. So we have some improvements in work item tracking that we call tagging, which I'm going to demo for you in just a minute. Web test case management is another one I'm going to demo in a minute, so I'll save that one. A bunch of unit testing improvements. We're finally having Windows Phone unit testing. Should be able to unit test your Windows Phone apps with Update 2. Some better ways of managing your unit tests. We have group by class, which is just another way to sort of group and manage your sets of tests. And we've also added playlists, which is a way to just create arbitrary sets of tests that you can then select as a group and run them and manage them. So it makes it super easy to run kind of the right subsets of your tests. And then another big thing we're doing is we've gotten a lot of feedback from customers about fakes and stubs and the desire that it's really cool stuff. People love it, but the fact that it's only an ultimate means that the people on the team who have premium can't run the unit tests, and boy, that's a really big problem. So we're moving fakes and stubs down into premium, so it'll be both in premium and ultimate, and the whole team will be able to take advantage of fakes and stubs. We've added Office 2013 support kind of across the board, SharePoint, Office, all of the Office 2013 support. And then Blend is back. So in 2012, we didn't ship a new copy of Blend. It wasn't ready. We were committed to continuing forward with that capability set. Blend is now back with support for WPF, Silverlight, and Sketchflow. So that will be included in Visual Studio Update 2. And is in the CTP, so I encourage you to check it out. All right, so let's do a few demos. I want to show you a few of these things that we've got here. So let's start with work item tagging. So I'm going to demo almost everything I'm going to demo here today is on the Team Foundation service, and I'll try to be a little clear about sort of where each feature is available. But almost everything I'm going to demo today is available on Team Foundation service now. So work item tagging is one of the things that the feature flag, is it on yet?
Yep.
The feature flag is on, so you can go try it now if you have a Team Foundation service account. So what you may know in Team Foundation service, that you can't customize it. We have not enabled customization yet. So if you want to add new fields, if you want to add new pick list values, we have not enabled that currently. We will, but we haven't yet. And if you've done much with TFS, you'll also know that even for on-premises TFS, customization can be a very involved thing for particularly a small team that just wants, you know, super simple ways to categorize, query, filter, going through the process of, you know, editing all my work item types and creating the fields that I want and form layouts. It's a bit more than a small team wants. A small team particularly just wants a list of issues and be able to deal with them simply. So we've added tags, and tags are on sort of all work items, and we've exposed it in a couple of places. I'm going to start with the product backlog. I'm going to maximize this so you can see the whole thing. So you'll see over here, I've got a list of tags on each of these work items, and you know I can open one and show that there's a list of tags associated with each one. Up here I've got a tag field. I can pick, let's say I want to look at things that are tagged with customer and maybe also tagged with web. So a super easy way to filter these and get to the list. I can remove all the tags, you know, the filter super easy. If I want to maybe add a new item, a new user story, which is, check inventory. Inventory availability. So I've added that user story to my backlog, and then on that user story, maybe what I want to say is, hey, that that feature is for an engineer. It's And you can just type. It's a web feature, and it automatically filters. And you know, that's going to require ERP integration, and I'd like to have a tag for that, but I don't have one. So I can just type ERP, and automatically that tag is added. So super simple, easy, flexible way to add tags to work items. It now shows up here. So now I've got this very simple way to just categorize my work items, filter them, find what I'm looking for. We've also added that, in addition to being able to do it on the backlog, we've added the ability to do it in any of the work item tracking queries. So let's just pick a query. Here I've got some work items in my query. You'll notice I don't have any tags on it right now. I can go into columns, go to the tags, add the tags column. It shows up. Again, pick this, start filtering, filtering my work items by tags. So we're pretty happy about this, and in general, it fits with our direction that we've been on recently, with really trying to streamline the experience of using our ALM solutions and make it as sort of simple and flexible as we possibly can. So the second thing I want to talk about, let's unfilter that. So if you're watching closely and paying attention, you'll notice that there's this new thing called test up here, which has never been there before. So we've added a new hub to Team Foundation, or to Team Web Access, called test, which allows me to do, let's go ahead and leave this page. I didn't save my query. That's okay. Which allows me to do sort of some testing in the web. So we've shipped a product in 2012 called Microsoft Test Professional. And Microsoft Test Professional has a rich UI. I don't have it running right now, but I can pull it up real quick. For creating test plans, enumerating test cases, describing test steps, then executing your test plans, reporting progress against them, etc. And people have generally been very happy with it. One consistent piece of feedback we've gotten from a number of customers is, hey, I like it, but in my production test environment, I'm not allowed to install any software on that system that's not part of the production environment, because it could invalidate my testing. We need to be able to do the testing with nothing but the production environment installed. And of course, right now, our test professional requires that you install the client in order to do that. So, you know, that plus the desire for cross-platform testing, to be able to test on Macs or whatever, is also something that people have been asking for. So web test case management and web test execution gives me the ability to do that. So here I have, on the left, I have a list of requirements or user stories that I'm going to test. Associated with each one, I have a list of test cases. I can add a new test case super easy. Just come in here and say new test case, and I can add test steps. Run app, click this, click that. Oops. I expect success. All right, so I sort of do that. I'll attach screenshots and attachments and stuff like that. And so I've now added a test case, and it shows up here. I can see here who the tests are assigned to. I can see what the state is. So this one clearly I've run and it passed. These others I haven't run yet. So let's pick one that I've actually created a test case for entering a backlog item in Team Foundation Service. So let's run that test case. And you see this little window pop up on the side, and that's sort of the web-based manual test runner that says, okay, run the app. So I'm going to click on the link, take me to the app. And it says, all right, oh, so that seemed to work. I'm happy with that. Good. Click on work. Yep, good. That seemed to look good. Enter a title for, oops, I clicked on the wrong thing. Enter a title for this. Okay, a new user story. Okay, good. That worked. Click add. Okay, good. And and then drag the user story to the top. Well, it's already at the top. That's good. So I'll call that good. All right, great. So that worked. I could, if I'd hit a problem, I could right immediately here create a bug, and that would pull up the web access for creating a bug, associate it to this test case and all of the kind of rich interactions that we have. I can save and close that. And then you'll see, of course, immediately that that test case shows up as passed. And I can filter and do all of that. So a very nice experience for being able to do your testing from a browser. So that is, that's in update 2. It's in the CTP that you're getting. It's live on Team Foundation Service now. So check that out. Thank you. All right, so the next one I'm going to show you is not yet in your hands. I want to demo it because it's cool, but you will get it in the next CTP. Right, Greg? Next CTP. Okay. So you'll know in August we shipped Kanban support. We originally started out with Kanban support saying there are four sort of what we would call minimal things we need to have for Kanban support. We need to have a Kanban board. We need to have work in progress limits. Oh crud! What was the third thing? The CFD, the cumulative flow diagram, and we needed to have customizable states. We needed to make it super easy to, because in Kanban, you know, as opposed to sort of other processes, states proliferate. You end up with tons and tons of states that you want to manage your work through, and it's got to be super easy to do. So we have our Kanban board. I've got a backlog. I can switch to the board. So this is, you know, you've seen this. This is in update 1. There's now this nice little link over here called Customize Columns. So maybe I don't like these columns. I want, maybe I want to say my states are design, development. All right, I'm going to be very waterfall-y in here. Just, oops, I closed it before I meant to. Maybe I want to add a code review state. And maybe I want to, let's see, so design is kind of an active kind of state, and I'm going to let Greg talk more about this later, but this allows you to map your Kanban states to kind of roll-up reporting, to be able to do roll-ups while allowing sort of each team to manage their list of Kanban states separately. I can roll up those states to active. I'll call code review, resolved, and maybe we'll have an integration testing. All right, good. So I've got my states, and now you'll see, and let me maximize that. I've got my board. Now automatically those states show up, and I can start moving my user stories into the right, double-clicked, into the right states. Maybe that one's in code review, and this one's in integration testing, and, I don't want 10 work items. Is that in customized columns? Yes. I don't want 10 work items in code reviews, so I want to set my my WIP limit to 5 for things that are in code review. So now I'll get an error if I get too many items in code review. That didn't refresh.
Did you do an integration test?
Oh, did I do it on any? No, there it is. I'm just looking at the wrong place. There it is. It's right there. Sorry. User error. And closed, et cetera. So I can do all this. Let's drag a couple more so that we get, something that's got a few things in it. And then you'll notice up here in my cumulative flow diagram, it's automatically reflecting the work items that are in the state. So it automatically adapts to the sets of states that I've defined. Super easy now. I feel like we've got a good, solid Kanban base to continue to build on with kind of the four key things. So that's that. You don't have it yet. I'm demoing off a VM that Greg gave me, but you will have it. You'll have that in your hands very soon. All right. Let's go back to slides for a minute. So those were kind of the four or the three key things I wanted to show. Now, let's move on. I want to talk about kind of another trend that we've seen. So another trend that we've seen in the industry is around the way developers are interacting. I talked about kind of distributed teams. Jason talked about modern applications. More and more are seeing people build these, you know, sort of cloud-connected device applications where the team is, as I say, very distributed. They each build different pieces. One team is building the iPhone client. Another team is building, you know, the Windows client. Another team is building a web client. And they're kind of working together. There's a lot of code reuse, a lot of sharing. More and more teams are taking advantage of code anywhere they can find it, incorporating open source. I mean, nobody wants to be reinventing the wheel. If someone's already done it, just build on it. Why start over and build something somebody's already done? I need to focus on delivering differentiated value in my application. So all of these have sort of created a trend in the way developers collaborate. Starting in the open source space with the introduction of distributed version control, I don't know, in the early 2000s, and sort of gradually growing popularity of distributed version control. And so we've seen that trend happening. We've seen a lot of trends that are making that sort of seep now out of open source more broadly into the community. And of course, our users have been asking for us. So I snipped this off our user voice site this morning. What is it? It's 1,329 votes for enable distributed source code control. It's the number three user voice suggestion on our list. So as we sort of finished up our last product cycle and we were kind of looking at what are our big investments coming, we said, you know what, we're going to need to support distributed version control workflows in Team Foundation Server. It's a growingly important approach. More and more people prefer it. It works for certain types of collaboration better than centralized version control. Other types centralized work. So there's a role for both. Both are very important, but we're going to need to have a DVCS capability. So we kind of stepped back and did what we always do. Let's look at what the where the industry is. Let's look at all the solutions out there. Let's look at what people are happy with, what they're not happy with, and sort of decide what we need to do about it. So when we sort of look at what's out there in the ecosystem, the first thing that's kind of clear is Git's winning the DVCS sort of adoption curve. They are, that has been growing in popularity. It used to be there were, Git, BitKeeper, Mercurial. You saw a bunch of sort of alternative DVCS systems. I think that race is largely over at this point. Git is almost synonymous with DVCS. And the other thing that's really interesting about Git is it's become much broader than a version control system. It's actually become a protocol. Like developers use Git as a way to move files around. So, for example, if I want to deploy to Azure, I can just push from Git to the Azure endpoint, and the files go. Or Heroku, same thing. If I want to deploy to Heroku, I just push. Facebook added a Git deployment protocol. More and more, it's sort of the standard interchange format, both at the protocol level, but also at the version control system level. Like everybody's adding Git export for their version control system. And lastly, Git has good cross-platform support, good heterogeneous support. In fact, one might argue that the biggest issue historically with Git has been that it didn't support Windows as well. It was not as nice an experience on Windows as it was on Unix. So, this was clearly, heavy on our minds as we were thinking about how we were going to approach DVCS. And so, we kind of asked ourselves, look, if this is where the industry is, why don't we just adopt Git as the distributed version control system for Team Foundation Server? So today I'm announcing that is what we have done. In fact, that feature flag has been thrown. Git support is on in your account right now on Team Foundation Service, and I encourage you to go and try it out. So I am going to go do a demo. So let's start. I'm going to go to my account home. So this is what you will see when you go to Team Foundation Service, when you go to your Team Foundation Service account today. You will see that there's this new button called New Team Project Plus Git. So when you create a team project now, you get to choose. Do I want Team Foundation version control, or do I want Git? And I just click this. It's sort of the same experience. I can even here pick which one I want. But of course, I've already got a project that's set up with Git. So let's go look at that. So the first thing to notice is it's just Team Foundation Server. So it's, you know, it's the same experience. You've got your homepage. You've got your work management. So all that backlog stuff I was showing with the tagging and all of those capabilities, the build automation, the test case management stuff I was showing. It's all there. It's your Team Foundation Server project. But your version control is Git. So if I go to the code tab, first thing you're going to do is look at this and go, wow, that doesn't look much different than what it has before. Well, it's your source tree. How do I know this is Git? Well, the first way you can tell this is Git is in Team Foundation source control, you would have expected to see your branches over here in the tree because we put branches in path space. In Git, branches are global. So you have a branch selector, and I just quickly and easily pick which branch I want to be working on, and the tree changes to reflect that branch. The other thing is I can click here and get the URL to my Git repo. So an important point I want to make, our hosting of Git, it's not Microsoft Git, it's Git. So if you want to use Xcode, you just take this URL and you paste it into Xcode and you connect with Xcode to our Git repo. If you want to use the msys git command line or any other open source command line for Git or any other Git tool set, you just use this this URL and you connect with your Git tooling to Team Foundation Server and party on. It will work. It is a full fidelity Git implementation. But we've been making a bunch of improvements over the past couple of months. In fact, I sort of blogged and hinted that we're busy investing in version control right now, and our version control web experience has gradually been getting better. So that web experience, it's the same. It works for both Git and Team Foundation Server, so I could be demoing this on either one. But really quickly, I can easily look at the history. There's a particular change I wanted to look. There it is. So if I want to look at a change, I click on it. I can see, who made that change. I get work item association. What is that you say? Work item association with Git? Really? Does that work? Yes, it does. So we have full ALM integration with Git. It's not just, this thing bolted on the side. You can do work item association. You can do build automation. You can do testing. You can do all of that stuff with Git. Here I've got my inline diffs. We've even added support for image diffs. So if you changed an image, clearly Martin was having some fun with this poor fellow and drawing an evil mustache on him. So it's full Git. We also are super thoughtful as we've approached Git about sort of enterprise readiness of Git and making sure that Git is palatable and good in the enterprise. So we've done a bunch of work around auditing done Active Directory integration, so it picks up your Active Directory credentials. We've done work around high availability, online backup and restore, like all of that kind of stuff. We provide the same kind of enterprise-grade capabilities with Git hosted in your repository as we do with TFS version control in your repository. And we also, by the way, have GitTF, which is a tool we released last summer that enables you to move code back and forth. So I can sync out of Team Foundation version control and I can push to Git, I can pull out of Git and I can push into Team Foundation version control. So you're not stuck. It's not like, hey, you've picked and now the two are islands and there's no boat that goes between those islands. There is a boat that goes between those islands. All right, so that's Git in Team Foundation Server. That's cool. That's a neat thing. But, that's only half the story. We have also added, let's click the Oh, I know what that is. Using the Visual Studio icon for the web browsers confused me. All right, we've added Git to Visual Studio. So here I've got Visual Studio connected to Team Foundation Server. I see Team Explorer. It just looks like Team Explorer. This is Team Explorer as you know and love it today. But you'll see a new little icon here, which is our Connect to Team Projects icon. And if I click on that, this is a new page that we've added to help me manage my various projects. So I see a list of Team Foundation, in this case, services, but they're projects that I have access to on Team Foundation Service. They might also be enterprise copies of Team Foundation Server in my network. You'll also see local Git repos. So this is able to identify local Git repos on your machine and make it super easy for you to interact with those. So in this case, Fabricam apps, you can tell by the icon, this little purple icon is Team Foundation Server version control, and the orange icon is Git version control. So I can double-click on that and open that project. And notice we now see that I've got a similar-looking Team Explorer page, but it's the Git changes page. And it's telling me, hey, you don't have this repo locally yet. So this project is up on the server. You know, you should clone it locally if you're going to work with it. So let's click clone. And it's just going to ask me where I want to put it. I'm like, hey, that's a good place for it. So that's going to pull it down out of Git and on the server and create a local Git repo on my local machine. And that then is just genuinely, it's a Git repo. There's nothing special about it. It's a Git repo you can use any Git tools on. So let's open that in Explorer. Let's go into a sample. And let's take, I'm just going to drag that out of there into Visual Studio. And open that solution. So I've now opened that solution in Visual Studio. I can, you know, make some changes. Let's say just super simple changes. A comment. Oops, I'm not going to be able to type. Sorry about that. Not going to worry about it. Notice the little checky box over here. So we've now got Solution Explorer integration with Git. You can see that it automatically detects that it's checked out. Now, maybe I want to commit that change. So notice when we are using working with a Git repo, we use Git terminology. So it's commit, not check-in. We want to be sort of mindful of adopting Git terminology. So here I go to a page which looks a lot like the Team Foundation Server version control page, but it's Git as identified by this nice little branch selector here. So I've got program.cs, I've made this change, and I'm going to say, hey, this is a change, fixed #123, and I'm going to commit that. Yep, save that. All right, cool. And now maybe I also want to maybe add a class to this. Add class. Yep, that's good. We'll just call it class one because I'm boring. Another comment. Notice that we've got the little, if I can find my mouse, the little plus mark next to that. I'll save my changes. Right-click and commit those. All right, so I'm going to just add that file, and I'll commit that change. Okay, good. So it's fully integrated version control with Git. I'm doing commits locally. Remember, Git is a distributed version control system. So when I'm working, I could be on an airplane doing this. I'm just making my local changes. I'm committing. I can say, hey, let's go look at those commits that I've made. So I've added a couple of commits. I've got a change, got the change, and I've added a file. But you know, maybe someone else has been working while I've been working. So let me go kind of look and see if anybody else has done anything. So I hit fetch. And fetch says, hey, pull down off the server any work that's been done on the server. And sure enough, it looks like Martin's been getting ready for his demo over there. So he's got a commit that he's checked in. So I'm going to pull that into my changes and merge my changes with it. I get a merge commit set up. And, you know, I'll test that and make sure, everything's good. and I'm happy now, so I'm going to push all my changes up to the server. So now those check-ins fly up to the server. And let me go back. I want to show you. So I go back to the web UI. And look at the commits, and here they are. So there's my added file. There's the change. By the way, didn't pick it up. Martin? Oh, well. It should have picked up my work item association there and associated that with work item number 123, but it didn't. So we seem to have a bug there, but we'll figure that out. That is a way to associate your changes. But so, you know, I've pushed it to the server. I see, as I said, on the server, all of the changes. So it didn't just roll up all of my changes in one check-in. It actually pushed all of my commits individually to the server. We will ultimately provide the ability to collapse them as well, too, if you choose. But it's on the server. All right, so that's cool. So I can work locally. I can merge easily with other people's changes. I can push it to the server. Let's create a branch. So one of the things that Git's known really well for is branches are super easy. So let's go create a feature one branch, and create branch, and just like that, that branch has been created. And it's super easy. And now I want, let's go back to the changes page. And let's make a change. So this is I need to commit that change. What am I doing? Hold on. Yeah, let's go and commit that change. Let's type it first. All right, commit that. Yes, I want to save it before I commit it. All right, good. So I've now committed a change. I can go back to, I can use this branch selector to just switch between branches. And you'll notice as I switch back and forth between branches, my code automatically updates on my local machine, and it's super easy for me to manage parallel development on multiple branches, switching back and forth. So the last thing I wanted to show is I know there are people out there going, yeah, that's cool. You've done Git. It's neat. We're super excited about that. But is it really Git? I'm having a hard time believing you that it's really Git. So show me that it's really Git. So I'm going to show you that it's really Git. Let's go to GitHub. And we'll go to the Windows Azure project on GitHub. And let's take, for example, Windows Azure Mobile Services. And take the URL for Windows Azure Mobile Services out of GitHub. Go back to Visual Studio. Go back to the Connect page. And say I want to clone. And paste in the URL for GitHub, for the project on GitHub. And hit clone. So that is reaching out to GitHub. It's going to download that repo onto my local machine. I can then open the solution on my local machine the way I did a minute ago, start making changes, do commits, and then when I'm happy, push those changes back up to GitHub. So it is a fully functional Git client. So a fully functional and compatible Git server, a fully functional and compatible Git client. So in terms of what you can get access today, The Git server is only on the service today. It will show up in Team Foundation server in the future, in the on-premises version, but today it's on the service. The client is an add-on to Update 2. It's not going to be in Update 2. You get Update 2, and then you get the Git v6 package that you can install on top of it, and you get the Git client support. The Git client support will be will be delivered in the next major version of Visual Studio. So we'll go back to slides, and I'll wrap up because I can see I'm already 5 minutes late, and Martin's over there going, Brian, get the heck off the stage. So that's Git integration. I want to talk briefly about some areas that we're going to be continuing to invest in. Obviously, a lot of progress already. You know, TS 2012 didn't ship that long ago, and we've already done a bunch of good stuff. Other areas we're focusing, Enterprise Agile. We're going to take our Agile solution and work on scaling it up to work for larger teams and more complex projects. We're focused. I talked a lot about trends in the industry. We're really focused on decreasing that cycle time and making you able to iterate rapidly. So we're going to be focused on doing some continuous feedback stuff, collecting information out of your deployed environment, making it easier to diagnose issues, easier to understand what your users are doing. Quality enablement, continued focus on making sure that you know, when you deploy it in production, it's going to work the first time, and then in the event that it doesn't, it's super easy to identify the problem. Work in the DevOps space and that handoff between developers and operations around deployment, around managing the flow of changes, around managing communication between the development and operations team, and then continuing to work on modern app development patterns with you know, things like the Team Foundation version control or the DVCS support. So get started today. Here's some links. Check it out, and I hope you enjoy it. Thank you very much. I appreciate you coming.
Thank you, Brian.